Well, I've been doing a few one-offs on Sunday mornings. This may be the last one before we embark upon a series, although I'm not going to make any firm promises. But I'd like us to turn then to the passage that we read a few minutes ago, Hebrews chapter 13. And we're going to look for a few minutes this morning at verses 11 to 14. I'll just quickly read those again. For the bodies of those animals whose blood is brought into the holy places by the high priest as a sacrifice for sin are burned outside the camp. So Jesus also suffered outside the gate in order to sanctify the people through his own blood. Therefore, let us go to him outside the camp and bear the reproach he endured. For here we have no lasting city, but we seek the city that is to come. And as we look at verses 11 to 14 then this morning, I would like us to do so under three headings. And first of all, a fitting image, a fitting image. So this letter is written to some Christians in the first century AD. These Christians, it seems, are Jewish, and these Christians, it seems, are struggling. In the past, they had been bright and lively in their Christian living, full of energy and enthusiasm, but much of that energy and enthusiasm appears now to have evaporated. The momentum has been lost. They have become shadows, we might say, of their former selves. Indeed, the decline has been so pronounced that people in the wider Christian community are getting worried about them. Certainly, the writer of this letter is getting worried about them, because in this letter, he does not hold back. He confronts these men and women with serious warnings. He warns them about drifting away, chapter 2, verse 1. He warns them about falling away, chapter 3, verse 12. He warns them about crucifying once again the Son of God, chapter 6, verse 6. He warns them about trampling underfoot the Son of God and outraging the Spirit of grace, chapter 10, verse 29. He warns them about shrinking back and being destroyed, chapter 10, verse 39. He warns them about failing to obtain the grace of God, chapter 12, verse 15. So you get the picture. Things are clearly not as they should be amongst these Christians. They are not just going along nicely, these people, in the life of faith, so that the writer can casually offer them a few little encouragements in his letter. No, these people are faltering. They're wobbling. They're flirting with disaster, so that the writer must get very robust with them and very heavy with them. And it all raises the question then, why? What's gone wrong? Why have these Christian believers found it so hard to maintain their original fervor and exuberance? Well, from bits and pieces that we encounter in the letter, we can detect at least two factors, I think. So factor number one, the external ordinariness of their Christian lives. The external ordinariness of their Christian lives. You see, now that they were Christians, they had no impressive temple building. And the visual drama of priests making offerings and animals being solemnly sacrificed, they had none of that. In terms of outward religious observances, all that they did now basically was meet together, probably in each other's houses, to do a bit of singing and to pray and to listen to some preaching, and that was pretty much it. As far as visual, tangible things were concerned, a cup of wine and a loaf of bread were as good as it got. And initially then, the stripped-down nature of all of this had been radical for them, and novel for them, and they'd rather liked it. But as the months went by and the years went by, some of them had struggled with it. Some of them had started to hanker after some excitement, something to relieve the mundaneness and spice things up a bit. So I think that's one factor in this decline amongst the readers of this letter, the ordinariness of their Christian lives. But then factor number two, their experience of rejection. Their experience of rejection. Of course, in their situation, rejection was inevitable. To be a Jew who no longer saw any value in the temple, who no longer saw any value in something as sacrosanct as the annual Day of Atonement. Worse still, to be a Jew who worshipped as God, a man called Jesus of Nazareth, that was basically to take a felt-tip pen and write across your forehead, "Reject me, please." Your Jewish friends and family members were going to regard you as a disgrace, an utter disgrace for becoming a Christian. The writer talks in chapter 10, verse 34, about people being put in prison and having their property confiscated. Those may have been the more extreme cases, I suspect, but again and again in the letter, he uses words like shame and reproach. That would have been a daily reality for these Christians. As they got on with their normal business, day in, day out, they carried with them all the time the stigma of being followers of Jesus in a Jewish community. So those appear to have been the two main factors then in the stagnation and even regression of these Christian believers. Both actually feature here in our text, but especially factor number two. Very much in the forefront of the writer's mind here is that experience of rejection. And he uses then a graphic picture to try and capture it. He has this phrase, outside the camp. It occurs twice, or outside the gate, it occurs once. Perhaps such language doesn't really mean all that much to us, because nowadays we have huge, sprawling cities which over time kind of merge with the smaller places around them. So that you have Longbenton and Gosforth and Forest Hall and Westmoor, and they're still sort of their own distinct places, but at the same time, they're part of Newcastle now. It wasn't like that in the ancient world. In the ancient world, the camp of a nomadic people or the city of a settled people, it was clearly defined. The camp had an edge, a boundary. The city had a wall with a gate so that it was possible to be removed, to be expelled, to be put out, and so to find yourself on the wrong side of the camp boundary. On the wrong side of the city wall. And that's the picture here in this language of outside the camp and outside the gates. It's the picture of the camp or city over here, with all its activity and its life and its community and togetherness going on. It's a happening kind of place, the camp, the city. But you're over here. You're outside. Hearing the distant buzz and seeing the distant lights of the city, but excluded from it all, outside where it's eerily quiet and cheerless and lonely. And that's the picture then that the writer uses to capture this rejection that's the daily experience of his readers. It's not a literal description of their situation. There's no evidence they had actually been removed from the city where they lived. But it's a powerful picture of the disdain that they were feeling from their community. It is, as my heading suggests, a fitting image. And it's a fitting image of what Christians increasingly experience in 21st century Britain. Whether it's because of our aversion to human beings being killed in the womb, or because of our conviction that marriage is an exclusive, lifelong union of one man and one woman and the only rightful context for sexual activity. Or because of our refusal to compromise on truthfulness and integrity in the workplace. Or because we don't show up when everyone else is going out clubbing on a Friday night. Or because we haven't watched the latest TV drama that's full of sex and nudity and we can't join in the conversation, therefore, about it. Or it's because we stay out of the office politics and refuse to run down that unpopular boss. For these and countless other reasons, we can be made to feel sometimes like such outsiders. I'm going to lower the tone for a moment and talk, as I do from time to time, about Mr. Bean. Mr. Bean is, of course, a comic figure, but he's also, in some episodes, a rather sad and pathetic one. And there's one episode, some of you may be familiar with it, and it's New Year's Eve, and Mr. Bean holds then a party on New Year's Eve, and at the party he has two guests. And the whole thing is a rather lame and dull affair. The two guests clearly aren't enjoying this party very much. They can't wait for the evening to be over. They keep furtively glancing at their watches. And at one point, Mr. Bean goes out of the room to get something, and the guests seize this opportunity. They dash quickly to the mantelpiece where there's a clock, and they alter the time on the clock, putting it forward by half an hour or whatever, so that just as Mr. Bean walks back into the room, the clock strikes midnight. "Happy New Year," the guests exclaim, and they all sing Auld Lang Syne, and the guests then yawn theatrically and say goodbye and leave to go home. Or at least Mr. Bean thinks that they go home. In actual fact, as they are making their way out of his block of flats, they pass another flat in which a lively party, a much more lively party, is going on, and they decide to go in there and join the fun there instead. Mr. Bean, meanwhile, thinking that it's now past midnight, he climbs into bed. And he's been lying there for a few minutes when he hears, coming from that other flat nearby, the sound of people counting down. 10, 9, 8, and they get to 0, and all these voices start shouting and cheering, and there's the noise of corks being popped. Mr. Bean is confused. He reaches for a different clock in his bedside drawer, and he realizes that he's been tricked, and it's only actually midnight now. And in that moment, then, you laugh, but you also feel a bit sorry for poor Mr. Bean, this lonely figure in the darkness of his bedroom, excluded from the celebrations taking place just across the corridor. And so whether then it's the person in the ancient world languishing pitifully in the open countryside, the wrong side of the city gate, or whether it's Mr. Bean languishing pitifully in his bedroom away from the cheery New Year's Eve party, it's this idea, I'm saying, of being some kind of unwanted outsider. That's what the first readers of Hebrews were. In their community, unwanted outsiders, sidelined by their peers because of their Christian faith. And you may, to some extent then, find yourself sidelined by your peers at school, or at university, or at work, or at the local tennis club, because of your Christian faith. And when that happens, then it's not something strange, it's not something novel. It's just how it works and always has. According to Hebrews chapter 13, standing by yourself, looking at the city to which you once belonged, there in front of you, its gates now shut and locked, its life now going on inside there without you, that is a fitting image of what it's like to be a Christian. A fitting image. Secondly, this morning, a famous instance. A famous instance. You might be sitting there thinking, this is all a bit gloomy, Dan. As a Christian minister, you should be raving about how great it is being a Christian. But if you're saying that being a Christian means being that person you've just described, being that person languishing outside the camp, then it doesn't sound really all that great at all. Well, being a Christian is great. And I'm now going to sell to you this outside the camp existence. But in order to do so, I need to draw your attention, as our text does, to a famous instance of someone being removed outside, someone being put out. And that famous instance then is Jesus. And this is the thing about Jesus. In his case, it's literal. Mark, the gospel writer, tells us that on Good Friday morning, the Roman soldiers, having first had a bit of a laugh at Jesus' expense, they then led him out, Mark 15, verse 20. Led him out, that is, of the city of Jerusalem. So that for Jesus then being outside the camp isn't a helpful picture, a fitting image of the rejection and disdain he experienced. It's the actual reality. Verse 12 of our passage, Jesus suffered outside the gates. It's an aspect of Good Friday that perhaps we don't think about all that much. We sing, there is a green hill far away outside a city wall, but we perhaps don't ponder it all that much. It wasn't for merely pragmatic reasons, you know, that Golgotha, the execution site, lay outside Jerusalem's gate. It wasn't that there was just a bit more space out there for killing people. No, the point is that being led out of the city, that was an important part of the whole ordeal. It was signaling to the victim, and in this case then it was signaling to Jesus, you're not wanted here. You have no place here. You don't belong here. You're a piece of waste that we're now excreting. You're an unwelcome presence of which we are now ridding ourselves. And in the midst then of all the other aspects of Jesus' ordeal that day, we shouldn't overlook that one. There would have been a certain moment that Friday at which Jesus, Golgotha bound, would have passed the edge of the city. He would have moved outside of the city boundary. And that would have been a poignant moment for Jesus. He would have felt deeply its significance. I'm a reject. I'm an outcast. Do you remember Psalm 69, verse 12? It's the Messiah speaking throughout Psalm 69. And in Psalm 69, verse 12, he says, I am the talk of those who sit in the gate. And the drunkards make songs about me. I've wondered for years why it's of any relevance at all what people at the gate were saying. And it only struck me about 2 days ago that Jesus was led out of the city. He passed the gate. And the drunkards then, they would have been gathered there because they weren't welcome in the city. But even they are jeering at Jesus on this day. Well, we may be disreputable characters, unwanted in Jerusalem, but at least we're not as disreputable and unwanted as you are, mate. But how then does all of this help us? How does the fact then that Jesus suffered outside the gate help us when we find ourselves, metaphorically speaking, outside the camp? Well, I'm going to answer that by way of three words. And the first word then is participation. Participation. The end of verse 13 talks about us bearing the reproach he endured. But it's not as cumbersome a phrase as that in the Greek, actually. It's simply bearing his reproach. Perhaps disgrace would actually be a better word than reproach. We don't really use reproach, do we, much in our modern parlance. Disgrace is effectively what the word means. Bearing his disgrace. That's what the phrase is. In other words, then, when we find ourselves being excluded and being sidelined, and being looked down at because we're Christians, it's not some kind of coincidence that our experience resembles Jesus' experience a little bit. No, the writer is saying it is a participation in his disgrace. You see, as Christians, we are united to Jesus Christ. You all know that, don't you? We sang earlier this morning one line which I think sums up that whole concept of union with Christ perhaps better than any line in our hymns. Jesus and all in him is mine. So at conversion, we are united to Jesus Christ. We're joined to him. And that then opens the floodgate by which everything that is his becomes ours. Imagine it's summertime and there's been no rain for quite a while, and so you're watering your garden with a hose pipe, or indeed that's what you want to do, but you attach the hose pipe to the tap on the outside of your house, and you turn the tap on, and no water comes out of the other end of the hose pipe. And you can see where the blockage is in the hose pipe. You can see it's all twisted in one place. So you go and you turn off the tap, and you try to untwist this bit of the hose pipe that's all twisted. You think you've done a good job. You go and you turn on the tap again. Still no water comes out. You go and turn off the tap again. You do a bit more untwisting of this blocked part of the hose pipe. You go and turn on the tap again. Still no water comes out. By this time, you're getting pretty fed up. You're thinking, this thing's bust. What am I going to do about it? And you're kind of holding the thing like this. And you know what happens. Suddenly, all the water gushes out in your face. And you're thrilled at that. Why? Because it's a pleasant experience having loads of cold water suddenly gushing in your face? No, because it signifies the pipeline is working. Now, when you and I participate a little, and it is only ever a little, when you and I participate a little in Christ's disgrace, when you're a little bit at least of an unwanted outsider at school or at work, like he was an unwanted outsider that day in Jerusalem. Of course, it's not a pleasant experience in itself. How could it be a pleasant experience being an unwanted outsider? But it shows the pipeline is working. It shows that there is a connection between you and Jesus Christ. It shows that that union between you and Christ, by which you get so much, by which you get his perfect obedience, and therefore you're justified in the courts of heaven, by which you get his resurrection power, and thus you're able to fight sin and temptation every day, by which you get his privileged access into the courts of heaven and you're able to pray to God, Abba Father, night or day, by which you get his eternal inheritance and you have the brightest possible future lined up for you. That connection, that union by which you get all of that, it's working if you're sharing in his disgrace. If you're sharing in his disgrace, the union's there. And you're sharing in all those other marvelous benefits as well. And so I'm saying then that it's not such a gloomy concept. This business of we Christians being outside the camp. Because when we're outside the camp, it means we're participating in Jesus' disgrace. And if we're participating in Jesus' disgrace, we're participating in everything. Everything that is to be found in Jesus. So that's one word, participation. The second word, perspective. Perspective. I said that one of the factors in the decline of these readers of Hebrews was their hankering after the drama of old covenant religion, that whole sacrificial system. And you'll know then, many of you, that throughout this letter, again and again and again, the writer addresses that. And he tells them, look, it's not a bad thing that you no longer have all that drama and all those sacrifices and the temple and the priests and stuff. It's actually a wonderful thing because all of that, it served as a visual aid. It didn't really accomplish anything in itself. Killing bulls and goats, it couldn't actually do anything about the problem of sin in the human heart. It didn't achieve anything actually, but it pointed forward to one great priest who would offer one great sacrifice that would accomplish everything and fully atone for the sins of God's people. And the reason then, the writer keeps saying, the reason that you no longer need to bother with the visual aid is that the thing the visual aid pointed to has now happened. Jesus is what it all pointed to. And he has now come and been the priest and been the sacrifice and secured the atonement. And here now in this passage that we're looking at, the writer even links Jesus' crucifixion outside the gate to that theme. Because in the visual aid, in the old covenant sacrificial system, it says in verse 11, the bodies of those animals whose blood was brought into the holy places by the high priest as a sacrifice for sin are burned outside the camp. Now, if you're interested in that, you can look it up in Leviticus 16. That's the Day of Atonement ritual. And in verse 27, it mentions this detail of burning the animals outside the camp. So the animal then, in that visual aid, remember we're saying the whole Old Covenant system, the whole Day of Atonement every year, it was a visual aid. The animal in that visual aid, it dealt with sin by being destroyed outside the camp. And so Jesus then, who really deals with sin, is destroyed outside the camp, outside of Jerusalem, at Golgotha. In other words, Jesus then is expelled from Jerusalem on Good Friday for two reasons. Number one, because the city doesn't want him. He's a reject. He's an outcast. They can't stand him. They're chucking him out. But number two, because he is the sacrificial victim atoning for all the sins of God's people. And does that then not put into perspective our experiences of being outside the camp? Because for us, it's only ever reason number one, isn't it? When we're excluded, when we're sidelined, when we're pushed out, it's only ever because they don't like us, because they don't want us, because they're treating us with contempt. It's never because we're the sacrificial victim on whom God is loading sins in order to then pour out his wrath. It's never for that reason. But it was for Jesus. It was for Jesus. In other words, Jesus' outside the camp experience was infinitely, infinitely, infinitely worse than any outside the camp experience you and I can ever have. And in fact, and I don't say this lightly, even if we were living in a part of the world this morning where persecution was much more fierce and being outside the camp really was a much more frightening thing than it ever is for us in the UK, even then, it couldn't be anything like it was for Jesus. Because Jesus went outside the camp not only as a reject of Jerusalem, he went outside the camp ultimately as a reject of heaven, a reject of God. God loading sins onto him and God pouring out wrath on Jesus. So I'm saying being outside the camp, it's not such a gloomy thing. I've emphasized the word participation and the word perspective. And then one more word, presence. Presence. Isn't the beginning of verse 13 fascinating? Therefore, let us go to him outside the camp. You'd have thought he'd say, let us go where he went 20 years ago in the case of the readers of Hebrews, the readers of Hebrews, or in our case, where he went 2,000 years ago. Let us go outside the camp because that's where he once went. But it doesn't say that. It says, let us go to him outside the camp. As if to say, that is where we'll find Jesus, actually. Outside the camp. And this is why then, in the last analysis, the Mr. Bean analogy is inaccurate. Mr. Bean, in his exclusion from the party, was a lonely figure in that bedroom. He had his teddy, but he had nothing else. You and I, excluded by our peers, who can't stand our beliefs and our ethics and our practices, we're not lonely figures, because we have Christ. We have Christ, his presence and his communion. You see, he doesn't reside amongst those classmates and those colleagues of yours. He resides outside the camp. As they push you away from their fellowship, they are pushing you into his fellowship. You needn't fear the place of rejection and ostracism outside the camp. It's a place that is graced by the presence of Jesus. I love that little touch in John chapter 9. Do you remember that story in John chapter 9? There's a guy that Jesus has healed, and he then gets a whole load of flack off the religious leaders in Jerusalem, this guy, because Jesus has healed him, and he's healed him on the Sabbath. And there's that whole long dialogue in chapter 9 between the man and the religious leaders, and the man's parents are even brought in and they get involved. But in the end, we read in verse 34, they rebuke the man. You were born in utter sin. Would you teach us? And then John says, and they cast him out. So they cast this guy out of the synagogue, probably means. And then look at the next verse, verse 35. Jesus heard that they had cast him out, and having found him, he said, and so it goes on. Isn't that a lovely picture? Jesus looking for the man whom the religious leaders had chucked out, and he finds him, and he speaks with him. And that's still what Jesus does. Jesus loves his rejected ones, those who have been rejected in school or work or on social media or wherever it might be. Jesus loves his rejected ones, and he finds them, and he draws near to them, and he blesses them with his communion and his presence and his fellowship. And so I'm saying it's not such a gloomy thing being outside the camp. It's a participation in Christ's disgrace. It's put into perspective by the fact Christ outside the camp suffered far, far more. And it's a place where we even find the presence of Jesus. And so, a fitting image, a famous instance, but then thirdly and finally this morning, a further incentive. A further incentive. Because our text closes then with verse 14, which reads, "For here we have no lasting city, but we seek the city that is to come." And the writer is simply saying there then that we shan't always, as Christians, be rejects. Our position isn't always going to be outside the camp, excluded from the city. No, he says, we have a city ourselves. We don't have it yet. It's a city that is to come, he says. But one day we shall be in our own city. And he's referring then, of course, to the coming age that will dawn with the return of Jesus Christ. Now, some of you may be horrified, I guess, at the thought of that coming age being a city. We're going to live in a city forever. I don't fancy that much. But this description of our future as a city isn't any more literal than the description in John 14, verse 2, of our future as a house. It's not that we're going to be kind of housebound for eternity. No, the literal description of our future, that comes in passages like 2 Peter that refer to a new heaven and a new earth. That's the literal description of our future. But these other passages like John 14 and like the several passages in Hebrews which refer to our future as a city, they bring out certain features, certain emphases, certain aspects of our future. And so the description then of our future as a city, it particularly brings out this point of inclusion. Inclusion. The people of this world can make us feel so cut off and so isolated and so lonely. And verse 14 is emphasizing that we'll never feel cut off and we'll never feel isolated and we'll never feel lonely in that future that is lined up for us. We will always then be the right side of the city gates. We'll be part of it all, fully belonging. And it's not just that there won't be anyone rejecting us anymore then, because actually we don't have to be experiencing rejection, do we, in order sometimes to feel a bit peripheral. I remember a few years ago, for some reason, the banner of Truth Ministers Conference was either very oversubscribed or they hadn't booked enough rooms for it. I'm not sure what the situation was. I booked a wee bit late and there weren't any rooms left, and so I had to stay in a travel lodge, which was about 5 miles away, and walk there back and forth at the end of each day. And it meant I enjoyed the conference still, but I felt a bit peripheral. I felt a bit cut off. You know, these ministers at the end of the day kind of let their hair down and get a bit silly, and I wasn't there for all of that. I was having to walk back to the travel lodge, and so I felt a bit peripheral. Well, we'll never feel peripheral, any of us, at any point in the age to come. We'll always be at the heart of everything. That's what this city metaphor is getting at. And remember again that cities in the ancient world, they weren't these sprawling places. They were tight. They were compact. And it's bringing out then that we're going to be always at the heart of everything. All of us are. You know, there's that story, isn't there, of Whitfield and Wesley, and they had this significant theological difference, and I can't remember which way around it was, but one of them was asked, "Will you see the other in heaven?" And he said, "No," which seemed very shocking. And then he went on to elaborate, "Because he'll be much nearer the throne than I will be." And it's a lovely story in terms of bringing out the graciousness of that man. But we mustn't think that actually our future is going to be the kind of this sort of theater, and there are going to be some who have front row seats, and then others who are going to be right in the very back and behind a pillar and having to use binoculars to see anything. No, we'll all be part of it. We'll all be at the heart of it. We'll all belong. Every single child of God will be fully immersed in the life of the new creation. There won't be the involved ones and the uninvolved ones. the central ones and the fringe ones. Everyone will be fully involved in all aspects of life in the new world. And so here then is a further incentive, I'm saying, to endure for now, for a little while, the exclusion, the temporary, fleeting exclusion that we may have to endure in this world, in our different contexts. Let's not worry, let's not fret. We have a future of stunning, exhilarating, thoroughgoing inclusion. Look forward, believer, to that. Amen.